Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Unless Congress acts to put more money in the Federal Highway Trust Fund by May, that fund is going to run out of money. And if that happens, road and bridge repair projects in every state will be severely cut back. Two senators, Democrat Chris Murphy of Connecticut and Republican Bob Corker of Tennessee, are sponsoring a bill to raise the federal gas tax by 12 cents a gallon over the next 2 years. Here's Senator Murphy.
This will raise enough money to fill the current gap and perhaps modestly increase our ability to make some long overdue infrastructure investments over the next decade.
And here's Senator Corker.
If something's important enough to have, it's important enough to pay for it.
So what are the chances that Congress will raise the federal gas tax, and what are some other options on the table? These are a few of the questions we have for our guest today, Congressman Peter Welch. Congressman, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. How do you feel about this plan to possibly raise the federal gasoline tax by 12 cents a gallon over the next 2 years? And if you don't like this idea, how would you raise new money for the Federal Highway Trust Fund? Do you think the United States should restore diplomatic relations with Cuba? What are the benefits for the United States? And should President Obama veto a bill authorizing the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline? Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. There may be other issues that you would like to talk to the congressman about, so feel free to give us a call. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Better yet, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. So let's start off with this plan, bipartisan plan in the Senate to raise the gas tax by 12 cents a gallon over the next 2 years. And just to put that in perspective, the gas tax now, I believe, is 18.9%.
The federal level, right?
Right. So it's a pretty hefty increase. And the bill would also index the gas tax to inflation after the first 2 years that it's in place. Would you support this bill?
Yes, I would. You know, potholes don't fix themselves. And we've got roads that are deteriorating here in Vermont, bridges that are in desperate need of repair. Also, we've got a lot of folks who want to go to work without wrecking their car. And by the way, the damage to cars on average is about $347 a year because of the wrecked roads. And I believe it's really important for our economy and for the safety of the traveling public that we maintain our infrastructure. And potholes don't fix themselves. And what Senator Corker said is correct. If something is worth having, then you've got to pay for it. And my view is that this inability of Congress to have a long-term funding source to meet our long-term transportation needs is a major failure. You know, last year, we just passed about a 5 or 6 month extension of the Highway Trust Fund by an incredible gimmick, an appalling gimmick. We took money out of pension funds, in effect, put potholes in pensions, and put that money into the transportation fund to last us until May. That's really, my view, disgraceful. So, you know, it's never easy to agree on a revenue source. Politicians go into a cold sweat when that's the vote that they have to do, but nothing's for free. So my position on this is that I'll support any reasonable revenue source, whether it's repatriation of corporate earnings. If that can be done in a practical way, I'll do it. If the only thing we can do is make an adjustment and raise the gas tax, which hasn't been done at the federal level since, I think, 1992 or so, then I'll do that. Because I think it's that important for our economy and for the safety of the driving public.
So President Obama has a plan to tax the foreign profits of American corporations. Realistically, what are the chances that this Republican Congress is going to go along with that idea?
I don't think it's realistic that they will. But there are Republicans and Democrats who want to do corporate repatriation to pay for infrastructure. I would support that. If as a practical matter we could get to 218 votes, I would do that. But what I'm trying to do now is get Democrats to make it clear to Speaker Boehner that we will cooperate with you in providing votes for a long-term transportation plan. He's got a tough job. because on his side, there's a lot of opposition to any revenue source even associated with transportation. So I want him to know that we will cooperate. I'll cooperate. What I won't cooperate with is another gimmick that just gets us 3, 4, 5 months down the road. I think that's just us dodging our responsibility.
Is there any possibility that Congress wouldn't act? I mean, it's hard to foresee that happening since it would affect thousands of bridge and road projects throughout the country. Everybody's got a vested interest in this.
That's right. But, you know, it's one thing to act where you do this gimmick like we did with pension smoothing and you only extend funding for 5 or 6 months. It's another thing to act responsibly where you have a longer term 5 or 6 year funding stream so that cities and states can plan and count on a revenue stream so that they can let projects out, get bids on projects. And frankly, that'll save us money in the long run because if you can do planning and projecting with the confidence that the revenue is there, you're going to be able to do a better job. So, I really think the issue for me is, are we going to do what we know we have to do, and that's provide funding and take the political heat that goes along with that? Or are we going to dodge it with another short-term plan that just continues the burden on our municipalities and on our states?
Is one of the basic problems that we have more fuel-efficient cars now? We have people driving electric cars. So relying on a gas tax per gallon is going to be a losing proposition in the coming years.
Well, that's the problem that we do face in the long term with the gas tax. You know, the more our cars are fuel efficient, and that's a good thing. The more we have electric vehicles, that's a good thing. So there are going to have to obviously be other ways to supplement the fund. But also, we just can't get around it. We haven't put any money into the fund. You know, the purchasing power of the existing gas tax is about a third less than what it was when it was last raised. And the cost of construction and everything is up 30 or 40%. So we're going in the wrong way here if we want to have any stability in fixing roads and bridges.
Let's go to our callers and start with Chris in Wallingford. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. First of all, I'd just like to say to Congressman Welsh, thank you very much for your excellent work in Washington. It's great to have an intelligent, reasoned voice representing us here in Vermont. Second, I just would like to raise the idea that gas tax should be increased even more because there are associated costs with driving cars and burning fossil fuels that go far beyond repairing our highways. We have a huge environmental impact from burning carbon-based fuels, and our cost for that ought to reflect it. And the higher the tax, the more people are going to be encouraged to use cars that burn less or burn nothing at all. And I'll take the congressman's comments offline. Thanks so much.
Well, I actually do agree with you on that. I mean, first of all, I think the gas tax or repatriation of corporate revenues, however it is we're going to get money to go into the highway trust fund, we've got to do that to meet our obligations to maintain and repair our roads and bridges. But then second, you're talking about the impact and the cost of carbon. And there's a lot of us who think that having that priced into the actual cost is a worthwhile policy, particularly if that can be paired with rebates to people to offset what the economic impact would be. Even some of the oil companies are in favor of that, but I think we're a ways away from being able to get that done. But the policy that you promote, I think, makes a lot of sense.
Let's turn to Kara, who's calling from Burlington. Hi, Kara. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Well, I was involved in the conversation here. It's very interesting. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to get back to President Obama's idea of the repatriating these companies who are bringing in profits from overseas. But, you know, I follow Bernie Sanders online, and he's also posting about, you know, companies like GE who are paying nothing in taxes. And while I agree with the last caller that, you know, increased gas taxes are going to discourage people from, you know, further damaging the environment, it seems like all of these initiatives are always placed on the back of working class people. And whereas these multi million-dollar companies bringing in billions don't seem to pay. You know, they have no burden, and I think that there something needs to be done in Washington that's a little bit more radical than a tax on working class people. And then here in Vermont, we've got a big problem with gas prices, and every price is going up. Price for electricity and you know, parking downtown. It's like, how much can you burden people to when big companies are not paying their fair share?
Okay, Kara, thanks very much for your phone call.
I agree with you, and I agree with Bernie. And there really are two issues. We've got a broken tax code. You know, we've got $2 trillion in offshore profits that have not been taxed. The tax on that has been deferred. And you have some companies that pay no taxes, and you have other companies that pay 25-35% in taxes, and the system is totally broken. And it's outrageous. I agree that everyday people are paying their share and then some, and some of these extremely profitable corporations are paying nothing at all. And that's why I am a strong supporter of tax reform. There's a separate issue here about how do you pay for our transportation system. And traditionally, we've always had users contribute to that, and that's what the gas tax is. But you are right, and I'm mindful of this. Pardon me. I'm mindful that, you know, finally with low gas prices, people are being able to save a few bucks, and that's a really good thing. So it is a burden, even with lower gas prices. But it's also a burden if we let our highways and our bridges fall apart. And it's also a burden on families if, because of the condition of the roads, it's wrecking their cars and costing them $347. So how do you find the balance? Well, I am all for the tax reform that is long overdue and is ripping off people in this country. And corporations, in many cases, are getting sweetheart deals. But I also do believe we've got a clear and present and immediate need to fix our roads and bridges. And by the way, there's good jobs associated with the folks who will be out there doing that hard work.
Today on the program, our guest is Congressman Peter Welch. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. We've been talking about a plan to raise the federal gasoline tax by 12 cents a gallon over a two-year period. What are your thoughts on that? We also are going to be talking about net neutrality and opening up diplomatic relations with Cuba. Your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. This morning, you convened a panel of small business people to discuss this issue of net neutrality. The head of the Federal Communications Commission, Tom Wheeler, said this week that internet service should be classified as a telecommunications service, essentially a public utility. Without going into too much of the detail on the technical side of this issue, why is this important?
It would give the Federal Communications Authority, the commission, the ability to make certain that we have access equality over the internet. Should you have the same access if you're a small blogger in Montpelier, Vermont, as, say, Huffington Post? Should you have the same access if you're Logic Supply, a small and growing company in Vermont, as if you're the same as Amazon.com? And we know the answer to that is yes. You cannot have fast lanes and slow lanes. You can't have preferential treatment. You can't have smaller users have their speed throttled. And bottom line, this internet is so essential both to democratic debate and to commerce that we've got to make certain that it just doesn't become a preferential access arrangement for the big players at the expense of the innovators, the individual bloggers, and everyday Vermonters living in rural areas. Title II. It allows the FCC to make certain that we protect that equal access or that access equality.
Some people think there should be preferential treatment on the internet, that, you know, that's how our business model works. It's a capitalistic system. And if you want to pay for faster access, hey, you get to do that.
Yeah, I disagree with that because I think the other values of what will happen to these entrepreneurs, who's going to be the next Netflix, who's going to be the next Amazon.com, you've got to give that entrepreneur an opportunity to have access to this tool. And somebody this morning made, I thought, was a great analogy. You know, if you're Comcast and you make somebody calls you, you have a right to have that call go through and you can answer the call. But if you're Bob Kinzel or Peter Welch and your son or daughter calls, you have a right to have that call answered. Should the big company have preference in having their telephone call answered over an individual talking to a son or daughter? I don't think so. And I think the internet is a similar analogy.
So the FCC, I believe, is going to vote on this at the end of the month. Does that end this discussion, or do you see that there are members of Congress who are going to try to overturn the FCC decision?
There are members of Congress who are going to try to overturn the decision. And here's the thing. It's got to be balanced. Some of the opponents of the Title II decision – by the way, that was something that President Obama supported and Mr. Wheeler is supporting – are fearful of the heavy hand of regulation. Now, what Mr. Wheeler has made quite clear is that he has no intention of having a heavy-handed regulatory approach like rate regulation, things that are associated with the days when you had a monopoly telephone service and it was highly regulated. That's not what we're talking about or what he's talking about. What you are talking about is giving, at the end of the day, the federal communication system the sufficient authority to guarantee that there will be access equality, whether you're a small blogger, as I mentioned, or small business in the hills of Vermont, or you're one of the big players like Netflix.
Today on the program, our guest is Congressman Peter Welch. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today is Congressman Peter Welch. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. If you have some thoughts about issues before Congress, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. We got this email from Bill in North Springfield who would like to know if members of Congress who agree with President Obama are considering a boycott of Prime Minister Netanyahu's upcoming speech before Congress. That'll be coming up, I believe, early next month. House Speaker John Boehner inviting the Israeli Prime Minister to come and speak before Congress. There are some Democrats who say, you know what? We're going to boycott this thing.
Well, that's right. Some of my colleagues are not going to attend. I will attend. But let me just talk about that because I think it's really important. Number one, I think it's very important for us to continue our best to have a very good relationship between America and Israel. Number two, I think both the Speaker and Prime Minister Netanyahu really made a major mistake in the way they handled this. The Speaker has the right to invite a foreign leader. But on the other hand, the normal courtesies are that you give a heads up to the administration, and the Prime Minister and his ambassador, neither of them did that as well. Third, the timing of this is really quite dicey. You've got the Iran nuclear negotiations that are underway. And in my view, that's absolutely the most important thing. We want a non-nuclear Iran. Those negotiations are at a critical point. Mr. Netanyahu has been very critical of even the process of negotiations. So does it make sense for him to come and speak in Congress essentially as an advocate in opposition to what the administration is trying to do that's important not just to us but to Israel? I think that's bad timing. And also there's an election in Israel, and there's a lot of turmoil there and discontent about whether this is a manipulative political move on the part of Mr. Netanyahu. And the Israelis will have to figure that out. So I think it was just bad timing and lack of, deference to the usual protocols. And my preference would be that the Prime Minister postponed a speech until after the deadline on these Iran negotiations and after the election. I don't think Congress should become a forum basically for political campaigns in other countries. On the other hand, I've always attended when I can, schedule permitting, visiting foreign leaders. And I believe on behalf of Vermont, my responsibility is to show respect for foreign leaders who come to Congress. So I will be there. Schedule permitting, and I think it will. Prime Minister Netanyahu asked me or Speaker Boehner, I'd say, why don't you postpone this?
So there are some members of Congress who want to impose additional sanctions on Iran before these negotiations finalize themselves, if in fact they do. What do you say to those members of Congress who want to have some additional sanctions right now?
It's a really bad idea. I have been a strong supporter of strong sanctions against Iran, but I want effective sanctions. And right now, under the interim agreement while these negotiations are taking place. There's intrusive inspections that are monitoring everything that Iran is doing with respect to nuclear activities. That's number one. Number two, the effectiveness of sanctions depends not as much on how, quote, strong they are with the letter of the law with which they're written, but the ability of us to maintain the support of our partners, Europe, including Russia, that imposes these sanctions. So if you have America passing strong sanctions, but then we lose our coalition that is helping us enforce sanctions because they see this as a political move on our part, then what are, quote, strong sanctions in fact become weak sanctions. And one of the agendas of Iran is to try to shift the blame in advance if these negotiations fail to the United States. So why in the world at this critical moment would we jeopardize our coalition that is making these sanctions strong and effective by doing something at this time? So no, I think that's a really bad move on the part of my colleagues.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Tim, who is calling from Orange, Massachusetts. Hey, Tim, welcome to the program.
Hi. My question is simple. Is it too late for President Obama to trade his opposition to the Keystone Pipeline in return for significant tax breaks for renewables and energy conservation, which are equal in weight to the tax breaks that the oil industry has enjoyed for decade after decade after decade? And again, I oppose the pipeline, but if we can't stop it, can we trade it for something of great value? And would that help persuade Republicans to accept either a carbon tax or other tax breaks for conservation and renewable energy?
Well, I like the spirit of your question because we should be dealing with a comprehensive all-of-the-above plan towards energy that helps us wean ourselves from dependence on carbon sources of fuel. And that kind of discussion is, if we were more better at doing our jobs in Washington, is the kind of discussion we'd be having. I don't think in the context of the Keystone Pipeline, the way it's become so politicized at this point, that we'll be able to have it. But and I'll tell you, there's a couple of reasons. One is it has become a political battering ram to some extent. Number two, Congress never has become, in effect, a permitting agency, and there's a process that's being bypassed by this vote. Three, there's a provision in the Keystone thing that's pretty appalling. It exempts a foreign company, TransCanada, from any obligation to pay into cleanup funds that all of our American companies have to pay into when they're getting a pipeline permit. So in the politicized situation that we're in with Keystone, I don't think your very sensible suggestion about having a broader conversation will work. But I hope other ways I hope that there'll be other opportunities to do what you are suggesting.
Now, the premier of Alberta, Jim Prentice, was in Washington late last month to try to drum up congressional support for the Keystone Pipeline, because the pipeline would take oil from the tar sands of Alberta down to the Gulf Coast in Texas, the refineries there. And he made this point, and I'd like to get your reaction to it. He said, you know, if you block the pipeline, we're still going to send oil from Alberta down to Texas. The alternative is it's going to go by train. So you got a choice. Do you want a pipeline, or do you want to see this shipped on the train, which he says is environmentally worse than the pipeline?
Well, he's got a point on that. But the question is, with this pipeline, are we really facilitating it? And also, you know, the pipeline question, by the way, they have other actions too. They could build their own pipelines to the east or the west coast. So it's within the power of the Canadian government to get that tar sands oil out into the market if they want. By the way, this whole question on trains, which are dangerous, is raising the question about long overdue look at the safety regulations that apply, because we have had a lot of crashes there. So there is a point that he's making. I mean, a pipeline is safer than trains, but it sort of bypasses the whole question about the wisdom of getting this tar sands oil out and into the stream of energy. It is the dirtiest oil there is. It's not light, sweet Texas crude. It's much more carbon polluting. That's one. Number two, there is a process, and I really don't believe Congress should be bypassing it. And three, I don't think there should be some sweetheart deal for a foreign company that they don't have to pay into cleanup funds.
So on the whole idea of dirty oil, he also addressed that question and said it's really unfair to attack Alberta and the tar sands oil as being quote-unquote dirty oil when the United States imports heavy crude from Nigeria and Venezuela. And his quote was, "We're seeing policy proposals that are designed to exclude Canadian oil from the U.S. market while giving a free pass to comparable oils from other countries."
Well, you know, he's got a point. But let's be clear here. To some extent, this whole question of Keystone has become a metaphor for whether we're going to continue to completely rely on carbon fuels or whether we're going to start trying to make transition to cleaner energies. And tar sands became an issue that symbolized for many this addiction that's unhealthy and, in my view, unsustainable for our planet to rely on carbon fuels. And it became a symbol in part because the oil there, the extraction process, the oil itself emits millions and millions more tons of carbon pollution into the sky. And it became a vehicle where organizers were not just talking, I believe, about that particular oil, but they were talking about the failure of Congress to address in an energetic and effective way the need to get to cleaner fuel sources and more sustainable fuel sources for the long run. So there is an element of politics here, but it's a legitimate political issue. We should be having much more of our investment in clean and sustainable energy resources. We should be doing much, much more than we are on energy efficiency. You know, Vermont got that a long time ago. But if we had much more commitment to energy efficiency, we could reduce carbon emissions by 40%. So I think some of these contradictions that you've pointed out and the premier pointed out, they are true, but it's the way that people get engaged in the political process and basically say, hey, we've got to start getting off our addiction to oil.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Michael in Williston. Hey, Michael, welcome to the program.
Hi, I would just like to go back quickly to the question about the gas tax, being that it is inherently progressive and regressive, and it doesn't talk about, we don't talk about some of the other alternatives that are related to it. Instead of a flat tax, there certainly could be ways to associate it with the kind of vehicle you're driving, and that could be put into barcodes or electronic readers that are part of your license. I mean, it registers your car, it knows who you are. You could get exemptions if there would be. I mean, there's lots of opportunities to open up instead of just saying, oh, well, it's this X many dollars per gallon, period, and not take a broader look at the kind of vehicle that's being driven. I mean, a truck, for instance, a pickup truck, big pickup truck, is a lot different than a tiny little Fiesta or something.
You know, you're right. But let me tell you the situation that I'm in, all right? I'd like to take a broader look. I'd like to do corporate repatriation, and I'd be willing to put that into transportation, vehicle miles traveled. I mean, there's a lot of really good ideas out there. But I'm in a Congress where, particularly on the Republican side, where they have the majority, they're not willing to put anything on there that raises any money for any reason in any way. So what I'm trying to do is indicate to the speaker that, look, I'm going to be there on a revenue source. You've got the hard job of getting a revenue proposal on the floor that will get 218 votes. And if he could put one on that had a lot of your ideas in it, I'd say, Mr. Boehner, I'm there. But what I'm seeing is that there's enormous resistance, and I'm trying to say we just can't let our roads continue to fall apart. We can't have our bridges be falling down. So I'm not going to have the perfect be the enemy of the good here, because what I'm finding with my colleagues is when they come up with some of these ideas, they're not so much about getting it done. They're using these ideas that they know won't pass as a way of avoiding the hard decision that we have to make. Where's the dough?
You know, this whole idea of a tax on the number of miles that you drive would require some kind of gizmo in your car that's going to track exactly how much you are driving. Do you have any privacy concerns about this, that apparatus will know where you're going, what you're doing, in addition to how far you're going?
I do. I have a lot. That's why I don't see that going anywhere. I mean, there's an equity issue here. If it's a user fee, then how do you know how many miles you went versus in tax on the basis of miles rather than gallons used? But there are enormous privacy concerns, and it's not going to go anywhere in Congress. But it's raising the point that many have made that a reliance on a gallon-based tax does not cut it because of the electric cars and because of the additional mileage.
I wanted to talk to you about Cuba before the program is over. Senator Leahy and Arizona Senator Jeff Flake have introduced legislation to lift the current travel ban for Americans to go to Cuba. Now, you visited Cuba a couple of weeks ago. Is this the first step to lift the travel ban?
It is, and I'll be co-sponsoring that in the House. But, you know, I'll tell you, I went down there with Senator Leahy, and, of course, he had been down there just a month before and playing a major role in the release of Alan Gross. And part of that, of course, was the president saying that we're going to normalize relations with Cuba. And I was there. My wife, by the way, is a fluent Spanish speaker. She went to grade school in Nicaragua. And we were out walking around, and we had the Cuban flag, American flag pinned. We had people coming up to us. They were so excited that they were going to have more of a relationship. They don't know exactly what that means, but they know that they want to interact with America. And what I found so refreshing about it, too, was excitement from Vermonters that they just know that treating a country as a pariah, even though we disagree with them in a lot of ways, we have relations and we engage. And Vermonters are quite excited about the possibility that we'll actually be able to engage, travel there, hopefully educational exchanges, hopefully commerce. When I was down there with Senator Leahy, I was with Senator Stabenow, who was the chair and now ranking member of the Agriculture Committee, and we're both trying to explore ways with the Department of Agriculture or their agricultural agency, how can we have dairy go down there? You know, right now Cuba is importing a lot of the dairy products from New Zealand. I mean, Vermont's an awful lot closer. Wouldn't that be good for us or Michigan? So I'm excited about it. It is a first step. Cuba's an oppressive political operation with the Castro brothers. My view is that opening up relations is not a favor to the Castro brothers. It's a threat because I think the more the Cuban people are exposed to some of the opportunities that may be denied them now, the more they'll demand it then.
So the plan to restore diplomatic relations with Cuba, as you're aware of, has drawn some very strong opposition in Congress. New Jersey Senator Robert Menendez says the plan is, quote, a bad deal that compromises bedrock principles for virtually no concession. And he went on to say the plan vindicates the brutal behavior of the Cuban government. What about those concerns?
Well, see, I think the opposite. I don't think it's a reward. I think it's a threat. I mean, you know, the Castro brothers have got basically a fence around the island. They control everything and they oppress people politically. Our non-engagement with them has not worked as a way to facilitate democratic development and opportunity in Cuba. So the policy has failed, even though a lot of the things Senator Menendez says are true about the oppressive political culture down there. But is it better for us and is it better for the Cuban people when we actually engage with them? And, you know, Senator Menendez is strongly against this. But when I was on the streets of Cuba with Margaret, those folks are really for it. So, you know, I take their views pretty seriously.
So we see the Cuban government talking about the need for the United States to reimburse Cubans for the long-term impact of those economic sanctions. Do you think these talks are actually going to result in diplomatic relations being restored?
Well, there's going to be claims on both sides. You know, the Cuban government took away property of many now Cuban Americans. And in fact, those people have, in my view, legitimate claims. The Cuban government's making claims of their own. And keep in mind, by the way, we did have the Bay of Pigs. I mean, the United States did some things here that a lot of us, including President Kennedy, thought were bad mistakes. So those are part of the intractable issues that will be negotiated over time.
We'll be following many of these issues in the weeks and months ahead. Congressman Peter Welch, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Coming up next, I'll talk with retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis about Senator Patrick Leahy's announcement this week that he will seek an eighth term in 2016. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Senator Patrick Leahy made it official this week. He will seek re-election to an eighth term in 2016. Leahy is the longest-serving senator in Washington and is completing his 41st year in the Senate. With us now to take a closer look at this story is retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis. Hey, Eric, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon, Bob.
There was some speculation when Republicans regained control of the Senate in November that Senator Leahy might not seek re-election in 2016 because the Democrats are now the minority party, and as a result, he's no longer chairman of the Judiciary Committee, he's no longer president of the Senate, but he says he wants to serve another 6 years in the Senate. What do you make of this announcement?
Well, first of all, Leahy clearly enjoys being in the majority more than he does being in the minority. And if you look back over his career since 1974, he spent roughly equal amounts of time in each. And when you're in the majority, you have much more of an opportunity to shape the flow of legislation, particularly through chairing a committee. However, the Senate does, because of its pretty open rules, allows all members to have a significant influence on the legislative process. So even as a minority party member, Leahy is one of the most senior members of the Senate, is an influential person. Plus, when he looks at the Senate seats that are up for election in 2016, what he sees is that only about a quarter of the seats up for election are held by Democrats. So with most of the Senate seats up in 2016 being Republican-held seats, there's a possibility that the Democrats could win back enough seats to regain control of the Senate in 2 years.
Do you think we're going to see Vermont Republicans trying to mount a serious challenge to Senator Leahy in 2016?
I don't believe so for several reasons. First of all, Leahy's electoral performance in recent cycles has been very strong, roughly 70% of the vote. Second, he has a huge war chest. It will be several million dollars by the time the campaign begins in earnest. But perhaps even more importantly, I think the Republicans look at other races in 2016 and see some very attractive possibilities. And I would put the governorship right at the top of that list. Governor Shumlin's narrow reelection with less than 50% of the vote in 2014 would indicate to many Republicans that if the GOP can coalesce behind a candidate for governor early in the cycle, and that person can raise a lot of money both in-state and get help from Washington and out-of-state groups, that Shumlin could very well be defeated, regardless of whether or not he decides to run. So I think the Republicans in Vermont are going to really put their emphasis in 2016 in trying to elect their candidate governor, as well as picking up a few more seats in the Vermont House and Senate.
As you mentioned, Leahy has a lot of money, just over $1 million in the bank right now. He's expected to raise a lot more. His campaign staff says they're going to do that because they're afraid that some national Republican groups might target him for defeat and there'll be lots of outside money flowing into Vermont. Is that likely to happen?
Well, I can see why Senator Leahy's camp would believe that and is worried about it. I mean, the outside groups, particularly on the conservative side, have talked about spending hundreds of millions of dollars in the 2016 cycle. The Koch brothers had a meeting with donors to their organizations out in Nevada a couple weeks ago, and they talked about a target to raise over $800 million. And this is just one non-party group. So obviously, Leahy and his people are concerned if a lot of out-of-state money were to come into Vermont. But my view, Bob, is that the Republicans and groups who support Republican Senate candidates are going to be concentrating on defending Republican senators who are vulnerable. There are a number of Republican senators up for election in 2016 who represent states that have voted Democratic for a lot of offices. That would be states like New Hampshire and Illinois and Pennsylvania. And all three of them have Republican senators up for election.
You were mentioning the gubernatorial race in Vermont in 2016. I get a sense there's a lot of talk in Vermont's political world that Governor Shumlin is a politically damaged governor because of his very close victory over Scott Milne in November and because he abandoned the single-payer health care plan. Do you agree with that assessment?
Well, my sense is that Shumlin is in a weakened position now. I'd like to see some polling evidence on Shumlin's approval ratings before making a definitive judgment there. But I think he's facing two problems. One is, before the 2014 election, his approval rating was less than 50%, and that's the vote share he ended up getting. And I'll be interested to see whether after the legislative session is over, he can get that approval rating back up over 50% or not. Second, he's lost a lot of core supporters because of his decision not to go forward with the single-payer health care plan. You have to think back that back in 2010, in a contested Democratic primary, the five-way primary, one of the reasons Peter Shumlin won that primary is the single-payer advocates worked very hard for him against other candidates like Doug Racine and Deb Markowitz and Matt Dunn and Susan Bartlett. And the single-payer advocates worked hard to see Shumlin reelected in both 2012 and 2014. And then he decided not to go ahead with the program without, in my view, giving them any heads up, giving them any advance notice of what he was about. So a lot of the single-payer advocates feel very disillusioned with Peter Shumlin right now. The Progressive Party has indicated that it will put up a gubernatorial candidate in 2016. That person might very well get a high single-digit share of the vote, almost all of which, in other circumstances, would have gone to the Democratic candidate. So you put together Shumlin's approval rating, the last time we've seen public data on it, of less than 50%, the strong likelihood of a progressive candidate for governor in 2016, and those things put together would, in my view, indicate that he would face a big challenge getting reelected in a three-way race against a Republican and a progressive.
So, Eric, how hard will it be for Shumlin to recover from this situation? What does he have to do?
Well, I think accomplishment in the upcoming legislative session is where it has to start, particularly doing something with the education, finance, and governance issue. Now, he hasn't come out with any very detailed plans on it. It seems that he's letting the education committees in the legislature, particularly the House Education Committee, take the lead on this. But if there's something that's passed, if the very large Democratic majorities in the legislature can pass something that, to use Obama's phrase, referring to health care, bends the cost curve downward in school financing and doesn't threaten many very small schools with a strong community identity, Shumlin could come out ahead on that. If, on the other hand, the legislature talks a lot about school financing and governance, but not much happens, and property taxes continue to go up because of declining enrollments, that makes an even more difficult political environment for him. Plus, a lot of legislators are wary about his plan to have a payroll tax to help deal with the Medicaid cost shift. If that's not passed, the cost shift will continue, and then you have issues about physicians being willing to take Medicaid patients, and you also have the continuing difficulties with Vermont Health Connect.
Do you see any scenario where someone from the Democratic Party actually challenges Governor Shumlin in a primary?
No, I don't see that. I think his challenge on the left, so to speak, may be more from a progressive, but I don't know whether Governor Shumlin will indeed seek another term or not. You know, in his memoir that was published last year, and former Governor Jim Douglas says that one of the reasons he stepped down when he did after four terms in office is that his view of recent Vermont history was that most governors stayed one term too long. They were not defeated for reelection, but that's an argument that others have made too, that governors lose their support the longer they're in office. And we've seen in other states, Mario Cuomo, the late governor of New York, being perhaps the best example of a long-serving governor who may have just stayed around one term too long and then loses his final reelection bid. So I'm not really sure whether Shumlin would decide to go for another term in 2016 or decide that three terms is it and would step aside. I think any announcement, it's premature to speculate about when that decision might be made. Historically, when governors have decided not to run for re-election, they've usually announced it in the fall of the year before the election year.
It'll be fascinating to see what happens. Retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis, many thanks for being on the program today.
My pleasure, Bob.
And that is Vermont Edition for today. On Monday, we're diving into a discussion of science and how scientific research is understood or misunderstood by the lay public. It'll be a discussion of inquiry, communication, and the public's baseline knowledge of science. That's Monday on Vermont Edition. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels and Rick Sengary with production assistance from Devin Karamblis. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.